Jessica sent herself through the quick, sense-clearing regimen, began a methodical inspection of the room's perimeter. It appeared to be about 10 meters square. From its placement above the end of the hall and from subtle differences in construction, she guessed it had been added onto the roof of this wing long after the original building's completion. She stopped at the south limits of the room in front of the wide reach of filter glass, stared around. Every available space in the room was crowded with exotic, wet-climate plants. Something rustled in the greenery. She tensed, then glimpsed a simple, clock-set servoc with pipe and hose arms. An arm lifted, sent out a fine spray of dampness that misted her cheeks. The arm retracted, and she looked at what it had watered. A fern tree. Water everywhere in this room, on a planet where water was the most precious juice of life. Water being wasted so conspicuously that it shocked her to inner stillness. She glanced out at the filter-yellowed sun. It hung low on a jagged horizon above cliffs that formed part of the immense rock uplifting known as the Shield Wall. Filter glass, she thought, to turn a white sun into something softer and more familiar. Who could have built such a place? Leto? It would be like him to surprise me with such a gift, but there hasn't been time, and he's been busy with more serious problems. She recalled the report that many Arakeen houses were sealed by airlock doors and windows to conserve and reclaim interior moisture. Leto had said it was a deliberate statement of power and wealth for this house to ignore such precautions, its doors and windows being sealed only against the omnipresent dust. But this room embodied a statement far more significant than the lack of water seals on outer doors. She estimated that this pleasure room used water enough to support 1,000 persons on Arrakis, possibly more. Jessica moved along the window, continuing to stare into the room. The move brought into view a metallic surface at table height beside the fountain, and she glimpsed a white notepad and stylus there, partly concealed by an overhanging fan leaf. She crossed to the table, noted Howard's day signs on it, studied a message written on the pad. To the Lady Jessica, may this place give you as much pleasure as it has given me. Please permit the room to convey a lesson we learned from the same teachers. The proximity of a desirable thing tempts one to overindulgence. On that path lies danger. My kindest wishes, Margot, Lady Fenring. Jessica nodded, remembering that Leto had referred to the Emperor's former proxy here as Count Fenring. But the hidden message of the note demanded immediate attention, couched as it was in a way to inform her the writer was another Bene Gesserit. A bitter thought touched Jessica in passing. The Count married his lady. Even as this thought flicked through her mind, she was bending to seek out the hidden message. It had to be there. The visible note contained the code phrase every Bene Gesserit not bound by a school injunction was required to give another Bene Gesserit when conditions demanded it. On that path lies danger. Jessica felt the back of the note, rubbed the surface for coded dots. Nothing. The edge of the pad came under her seeking fingers. Nothing. She replaced the pad where she had found it, feeling a sense of urgency. Something in the position of the pad? She wondered. But Howard had been over this room, doubtless had moved the pad. She looked at the leaf above the pad. The leaf! She brushed a finger along the undersurface, along the edge, along the stem. It was there! Her fingers detected the subtle, coded dots, scanned them in a single passage. Your son and the Duke are in immediate danger. A bedroom has been designed to attract your son. The H loaded it with death traps to be discovered, leaving one that may escape detection. Jessica put down the urge to run back to Paul. The full message had to be learned. Her fingers sped over the dots. I do not know the exact nature of the menace, but it has something to do with a bed. The threat to your Duke involves defection of a trusted companion or lieutenant. The H plan to give you as gift to a minion. To the best of my knowledge, this conservatory is safe. Forgive that I cannot tell more. My sources are few, as my count is not in the pay of the H. In haste, M.F. Jessica thrust the leaf aside, whirled to dash back to Paul. In that instant, the airlock door slammed open. Paul jumped through it, holding something in his right hand, slammed the door behind him. He saw his mother, pushed through the leaves to her, glanced at the fountain, thrust his hand and the thing it clutched under the falling water. "Paul!" She grabbed his shoulder, staring at the hand. "What is that?" He spoke casually, but she caught the effort behind the tone. "Hunter Seeker. Caught it in my room and smashed its nose. But I want to be sure. Water should short it out." "Immerse it," she commanded. He obeyed. Presently she said, "Withdraw your hand. Leave the thing in the water." He brought out his hand, shook water from it, staring at the quiescent metal in the fountain. Jessica broke off a plant stem, prodded the deadly sliver. It was dead. She dropped the stem into the water, looked at Paul. His eyes studied the room with a searching intensity that she recognized, the B.G. way. "This place could conceal anything," he said. "I've reason to believe it's safe," she said. "My room was supposed to be safe too. Howard said it was a hunter seeker," she reminded him. "That means someone inside the house to operate it. Seeker control beams have a limited range. The thing could have been spirited in here after Howard's investigation." But she thought of the message of the leaf. Defection of a trusted companion or lieutenant. Not Howard, surely. Oh, surely not Howard. "Howard's men are searching the house right now," he said. "That seeker almost got the old woman who came to wake me." "The shut-out mapes," Jessica said, remembering the encounter at the stairs. "A summons from your father to—"
"That can wait," Paul said.
"Why do you think this room's safe?"
She pointed to the note, explained about it. He relaxed slightly. But Jessica remained inwardly tense, thinking, "A hunter-seeker. Merciful mother." It took all her training to prevent a fit of hysterical trembling. Paul spoke matter-of-factly.
"It's the Harkonnens, of course. We shall have to destroy them." A rapping sounded at the airlock door, the code knock of one of Howard's corps. "Come in," Paul called. The door swung wide and a tall man in a tradie's uniform, with a Howard insignia on his cap, leaned into the room.
"There you are, sir," he said. "The housekeeper said you'd be here."
He glanced around the room.
"We found a cairn in the cellar and caught a man in it. He had a seeker console."
"I'll want to take part in the interrogation," Jessica said.
"Sorry, my lady. We messed him up catching him. He died."
"Nothing to identify him?" she asked.
"We found nothing yet, my lady."
"Was he an Arakeen native?" Paul asked.
Jessica nodded at the astuteness of the question.
"He has the native look," the man said. "Put into that cairn more than a month ago, by the look, and left there to await our coming. Stone and mortar where he came through into the cellar were untouched when we inspected the place yesterday. I'll stake my reputation on it."
"No one questions your thoroughness," Jessica said.
"I question it, my lady. We should have used sonic probes down there."
"I presume that's what you're doing now," Paul said.
"Yes, sir."
"Send word to my father that we'll be delayed."
"At once, sir."
He glanced at Jessica.
"It's Howard's order that under such circumstances as these, the young master be guarded in a safe place."
Again his eyes swept the room.
"What of this place?"
"I've reason to believe it's safe," she said. "Both Howard and I have inspected it."
"Then I'll mount guard outside here, milady, until we've been over the house once more."
He bowed, touched his cap to Paul, backed out and swung the door closed behind him. Paul broke the sudden silence, saying,
"Had we better go over the house later ourselves? Your eyes might see things others would miss." "This wing was the only place I hadn't examined," she said. "I put it off to last because—"
"Because Howard gave it his personal attention," he said.
She darted a quick look at his face, questioning.
"Do you distrust Howard?" she asked.
"No, but he's getting old. He's overworked. We could take some of the load from him."
That'd only shame him and impair his efficiency, she said. A stray insect won't be able to wander into this wing after he hears about this. He'll be shamed that...
We must take our own measures, he said.
Howard has served 3 generations of Atreides with honour, she said. He deserves every respect and trust we can pay him, many times over.
Paul said, When my father is bothered by something you've done, he says, Bene Gesserit, like a swear word.
And what is it about me that bothers your father? When you argue with him, you are not your father, Paul.
And Paul thought, It'll worry her, but I must tell her what that Mapes woman said about a traitor among us.
What are you holding back? Jessica asked. This isn't like you, Paul.
He shrugged, recounted the exchange with Mapes. And Jessica thought of the message of the leaf. She came to a sudden decision, showed Paul the leaf, told him its message.
My father must learn of this at once, he said. I'll radiograph it in code and get it off. No, she said. You will wait until you can see him alone. As few as possible must learn about it. Do you mean we should trust no one? There's another possibility, she said. This message may have been meant to get to us. The people who gave it to us may believe it's true, but it may be that the only purpose was to get this message to us.
Paul's face remained sturdily somber.
To sow distrust and suspicion in our ranks, to weaken us that way, he said.
You must tell your father privately, and caution him about this aspect of it, she said.
I understand.
She turned to the tall reach of filter glass, stared out to the southwest where the sun of Arrakis was sinking, a yellowed ball above the cliffs. Paul turned with her, said,
I don't think it's Howard either.
Is it possible it's Yui?
He's not a lieutenant or companion, she said. And I can assure you, he hates the Harkonnens as bitterly as we do.
Paul directed his attention to the cliffs, thinking,
And it couldn't be Gurney. Or Duncan. Could it be one of the sub-lieutenants?
Impossible. They're all from families that have been loyal to us for generations. For good reason.
Jessica rubbed her forehead, sensing her own fatigue.
So much peril here.
She looked out at the filter-yellowed landscape, studying it. Beyond the ducal grounds stretched a high-fenced storage yard. Lines of spice silos in it, with stilt-legged watchtowers standing around it like so many startled spiders. She could see at least 20 storage yards of silos reaching out to the cliffs of the shield wall. Silos repeated, stuttering across the basin. Slowly, the filtered sun buried itself beneath the horizon. Stars leaped out. She saw one bright star so low on the horizon that it twinkled with a clear, precise rhythm, a trembling of light. Blink, 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 blink. Paul stirred beside her in the dusky room. But Jessica concentrated on that single bright star, realizing that it was too low, that it must come from the shield wall cliffs.
Someone signalling.
She tried to read the message, but it was in no code she had ever learned. Other lights had come on down on the plain beneath the cliffs, little yellows spaced out against blue darkness, and one light off to their left grew brighter, began to wink back at the cliff very fast, blink, squirt, glimmer, blink, and it was gone. The false star in the cliff winked out immediately. Signals. And they filled her with premonition.
Why were lights used to signal across the basin? She asked herself. Why couldn't they use the communications network?
The answer was obvious. The Communinet was certain to be tapped now by agents of the Duke Leto. Light signals could only mean that messages were being sent between his enemies, between Harkonnen agents. There came a tapping at the door behind them, and the voice of Howard's man.
All clear, sir, m'lady. Time to be getting the young master to his father.
It is said that the Duke Leto blinded himself to the perils of Arrakis, that he walked heedlessly into the pit. Would it not be more likely to suggest he had lived so long in the presence of extreme danger he misjudged a change in its intensity? Or is it possible he deliberately sacrificed himself that his son might find a better life? All evidence indicates the Duke was a man not easily hoodwinked. From Muad'Dib, Family Commentaries by the Princess Irulan.
The Duke Leto Atreides leaned against the parapet of the landing control tower outside Arakeen. The night's first moon, an oblate silver coin, hung well above the southern horizon. Beneath it, the jagged cliffs of the shield wall shone like parched icing through a dust haze. To his left, the lights of Arakeen glowed in the haze, yellow, white, blue. He thought of the notices posted now above his signature all through the populous places of the planet. "Our sublime Padishah Emperor has charged me to take possession of this planet and end all dispute." The ritualistic formality of it touched him with a feeling of loneliness. Who was fooled by that fatuous legalism? Not the Fremen, certainly, nor the houses minor who controlled the interior trade of Arrakis, and were Harkonnen creatures almost to a man. "They have tried to take the life of my son." The rage was difficult to suppress. He saw lights of a moving vehicle coming toward the landing field from Arakeen. He hoped it was the guard and troop carrier bringing Paul. The delay was galling, even though he knew it was prompted by caution on the part of Howard's lieutenant. "They have tried to take the life of my son." He shook his head to drive out the angry thoughts, glanced back at the field where five of his own frigates were posted around the rim like monolithic sentries. Better a cautious delay than... The lieutenant was a good one, he reminded himself, a man marked for advancement, completely loyal. "Our sublime Padishah Emperor." If the people of this decadent garrison city could only see the Emperor's private note to his noble Duke. The disdainful allusions to veiled men and women. But what else is one to expect of barbarians, whose dearest dream is to live outside the ordered security of the Falfreluchers? The Duke felt in this moment that his own dearest dream was to end all class distinctions and never again think of deadly order. He looked up and out of the dust at the unwinking stars, thought, "Around one of those little lights circles Caladan, but I'll never again see my home." The longing for Caladan was a sudden pain in his breast. He felt that it did not come from within himself, but that it reached out to him from Caladan. He could not bring himself to call this dry wasteland of Arrakis his home, and he doubted he ever would. "I must mask my feelings," he thought, "for the boy's sake. If ever he's to have a home, this must be it. I may think of Arrakis as a hell I've reached before death, but he must find here that which will inspire him. There must be something." A wave of self-pity, immediately despised and rejected, swept through him, and for some reason he found himself recalling two lines from a poem Gurney Halleck often repeated. "My lungs taste the air of time, blown past falling sands." Well, Gurney would find plenty of falling sands here, the Duke thought. The central wastelands beyond those moon-frosted cliffs were desert, barren rock, dunes and blowing dust, an uncharted, dry wilderness with here and there along its rim, and perhaps scattered through it, knots of Fremen. If anything could buy a future for the Atreides line, the Fremen just might do it. Provided the Harkonnens hadn't managed to infect even the Fremen with their poisonous schemes. "They have tried to take the life of my son." A scraping metal racket vibrated through the tower, shook the parapet beneath his arms. Blast shutters dropped in front of him, blocking the view. "Shuttles coming in," he thought. "Time to go down and get to work." He turned to the stairs behind him, headed down to the big assembly room, trying to remain calm as he descended, to prepare his face for the coming encounter. The men were already boiling in from the field when he reached the yellow-domed room. They carried their space bags over their shoulders, shouting and roistering like students returning from vacation.
Hey, feel that under your dogs? That's gravity, man.
How many G's does this place pull? Feels heavy.
9/10 of a G by the book.
The crossfire of thrown words filled the big room.
Did you get a good look at this hole on the way down? Where's all the loot this place is supposed to have?
The Harkonnens took it with them.
Me for a hot shower and a soft bed.
Haven't you heard, stupid? No showers down here. You scrub your ass with sand.
Hey, can it? The Duke.
The Duke stepped out of the stair entry into a suddenly silent room. Gurney Halleck strode along at the point of the crowd, bag over one shoulder, the neck of his 9-string balisette clutched in the other hand. They were long-fingered hands with big thumbs, full of tiny movements that drew such delicate music from the balisette. The Duke watched Halleck, admiring the ugly lump of a man, noting the glass splinter eyes with their gleam of savage understanding. Here was a man who lived outside the Falfreluchers while obeying their every precept. What was it Paul had called him? Gurney the Valorous. Halleck's wispy blonde hair trailed across barren spots on his head. His wide mouth was twisted into a pleasant sneer, and the scar of the ink vine whip slashed across his jawline seemed to move with a life of its own. His whole air was of casual, shoulder-set capability. He came up to the Duke, bowed.
Gurney.
My lord.
He gestured with the balisette toward the men in the room.
This is the last of them. I'd have preferred coming in with the first wave, but...
There are still some Harkonnens for you. Step aside with me, Gurney, where we may talk.
Yours to command, my lord.
They moved into an alcove beside a coil slot water machine, while the men stirred restlessly in the big room. Halleck dropped his bag into a corner, kept his grip on the balisette.
How many men can you let Hawat have?
Is Thufir in trouble, sire?
He's lost only 2 agents, but his advance men gave us an excellent line on the entire Harkonnen setup here. If we move fast, we may gain a measure of security, the breathing space we require. He wants as many men as you can spare, men who won't balk at a little knife work.
I can let him have 300 of my best. Where shall I send them?
To the main gate. Hawat has an agent there waiting to take them.
Shall I get about it at once, sire?
In a moment. We have another problem. The field commandant will hold the shuttle here until dawn on a pretext. The guild highliner that brought us is going on about its business, and the shuttle's supposed to make contact with a cargo ship taking up a load of spice.
Our spice, my lord?
Our spice. But the shuttle also will carry some of the spice hunters from the old regime. They've opted to leave with the change of fief, and the judge of the change is allowing it. These are valuable workers, Gurney, about 800 of them. Before the shuttle leaves, you must persuade some of those men to enlist with us.
How strong a persuasion, sire?
I want their willing cooperation, Gurney. Those men have experience and skills we need. The fact that they're leaving suggests they're not part of the Harkonnen machine. Hawat believes there could be some bad ones planted in the group, but he sees assassins in every shadow.
Thufir has found some very productive shadows in his time, my lord.
And there are some he hasn't found. But I think planting sleepers in this outgoing crowd would show too much imagination for the Harkonnens.
Possibly, sire. Where are these men?
Down on the lower level, in a waiting room. I suggest you go down and play a tune or two to soften their minds, then turn on the pressure. You may offer positions of authority to those who qualify. Offer 20% higher wages than they received under the Harkonnens.
No more than that, sire? I know the Harkonnen pay scales, and to men with their termination pay in their pockets and the wanderlust on them, well, sire, 20% would hardly seem proper inducement to stay.
Then use your own discretion in particular cases. Just remember that the treasury isn't bottomless. Hold it to 20% whenever you can. We particularly need spice drivers, weather scanners, dune men, any with open sand experience.
I understand, sire. They shall come all for violence. Their faces shall sup up as the east wind, and they shall gather the captivity of the sand.
A very moving quotation. Turn your crew over to a lieutenant. Have him give a short drill on water discipline, then bed the men down for the night in the barracks adjoining the field. Field personnel will direct them. And don't forget the men for Hawat.
300 of the best, sire.
Gurney took up his space bag.
Where shall I report to you when I've completed my chores?
I've taken over a council room topside here. We'll hold staff there. I want to arrange a new planetary dispersal order with armored squads going out first.
Halleck stopped in the act of turning away, caught Leto's eye.
Are you anticipating that kind of trouble, sire? I thought there was a judge of the change here.
Both open battle and secret. There'll be blood aplenty spilled here before we're through.
And the water which thou takest out of the river shall become blood upon the dry land.
Hurry back, Gurney.
Very good, my lord. Behold, as a wild ass in the desert, go I forth to my work.
The whip scar rippled to his grin. He turned, strode to the center of the room, paused to relay his orders, hurried on through the men. Leto shook his head at the retreating back. Halleck was a continual amazement, a head full of songs, quotations, and flowery phrases, and the heart of an assassin when it came to dealing with the Harkonnens. Presently, Leto took a leisurely diagonal course across to the lift, acknowledging salutes with a casual hand wave. He recognized a propaganda corpsman, stopped to give him a message that could be relayed to the men through channels. Those who had brought their women would want to know the women were safe and where they could be found. The others would wish to know that the population here appeared to boast more women than men. The Duke slapped the propaganda man on the arm, a signal that the message had top priority to be put out immediately, then continued across the room. He nodded to the men, smiled, traded pleasantries with a subaltern. Command must always look confident, he thought. All that faith riding on your shoulders, while you sit in the critical seat and never show it. He breathed a sigh of relief when the lift swallowed him, and he could turn and face the impersonal doors. They have tried to take the life of my son.
Over the exit of the Arrakeen landing field, crudely carved as though with a poor instrument, there was an inscription that Muad'Dib was to repeat many times. He saw it that first night on Arrakis, having been brought to the ducal command post to participate in his father's first full staff conference. The words of the inscription were a plea to those leaving Arrakis, but they fell with dark import on the eyes of a boy who had just escaped a close brush with death. They said, O you who know what we suffer here, do not forget us in your prayers. From Manual of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
The whole theory of warfare is calculated risk, the Duke said. But when it comes to risking your own family, the element of calculation gets submerged in other things.
He knew he wasn't holding in his anger as well as he should, and he turned, strode down the length of the long table and back. The Duke and Paul were alone in the conference room at the landing field. It was an empty-sounding room, furnished only with a long table, old-fashioned three-legged chairs around it, and a map board and projector at one end. Paul sat at the table near the map board. He had told his father the experience with the hunter-seeker and given the reports that a traitor threatened him. The Duke stopped across from Paul, pounded the table.
Howard told me that house was secure.
Paul spoke hesitantly.
I was angry too, at first, and I blamed Howard. But the threat came from outside the house. It was simple, clever, and direct, and it would have succeeded were it not for the training given me by you and many others, including Howard. Are you defending him?
The Duke demanded.
Yes. He's getting old. That's it. He should be...
He's wise with much experience, Paul said.
How many of Howard's mistakes can you recall? I should be the one defending him, the Duke said. Not you.
Paul smiled. Leto sat down at the head of the table, put a hand over his son's.
You've matured lately, son.
He lifted his hand.
It gladdens me.
He matched his son's smile.
Hawat will punish himself. He'll direct more anger against himself over this than both of us together could pour on him.
Paul glanced toward the darkened windows beyond the map board, looked at the night's blackness. Room lights reflected from a balcony railing out there. He saw movement and recognized the shape of a guard in Atreides' uniform. Paul looked back at the white wall behind his father, then down to the shiny surface of the table, seeing his own hands clenched into fists there. The door opposite the Duke banged open. Thufir Hawat strode through it, looking older and more leathery than ever. He paced down the length of the table, stopped at attention, facing Leto.
"My lord," he said,
speaking to a point over Leto's head,
"I have just learned how I failed you. It becomes necessary that I tender my resignation."
"Oh, sit down and stop acting the fool," the Duke said.
He waved the chair across from Paul.
"If you made a mistake, it was in overestimating the Harkonnens. Their simple minds came up with a simple trick. We didn't count on simple tricks. And my son has been a great pains to point out to me that he came through this largely because of your training. You didn't fail there."
He stabbed the back of the empty chair.
"Sit down, I say."
Hawat sank into the chair.
"But I'll hear no more of it," the Duke said. "The incident is past. We have more pressing business.
Where are the others?"
"I asked them to wait outside while I call them in."
Hawat looked into Leto's eyes.
"Sire, I
know who my true friends are, Thufir," the Duke said. "Call in the men."
Hawat swallowed.
"At once, my lord."
He swiveled in the chair, called to the open door.
"Gurney, bring them in."
Halleck led the file of men into the room, the staff officers looking grimly serious, followed by the younger aides and specialists, an air of eagerness among them. Brief scuffing sounds echoed around the room as the men took seats. A faint smell of Rachag stimulant wafted down the table.
"There's coffee for those who want it," the Duke said.
He looked over his men, thinking,
"They're a good crew. A man could do far worse for this kind of war."
He waited while coffee was brought in from the adjoining room and served, noting the tiredness in some of the faces. Presently he put on his mask of quiet efficiency, stood up and commanded their attention with a knuckle rap against the table.
"Well, gentlemen," he said, "our civilization appears to have fallen so deeply into the habit of invasion that we cannot even obey a simple order of the Imperium without the old ways cropping up."
Dry chuckles sounded around the table, and Paul realized that his father had said the precisely correct thing, in precisely the correct tone, to lift the mood here. Even the hint of fatigue in his voice was right.
"I think first we'd better learn if Thufir has anything to add to his report on the Fremen," the Duke said. "Thufir?"
Hawat glanced up.
"I've some economic matters to go into after my general report, sire. But I can say now that the Fremen appear more and more to be the allies we need. They're waiting now to see if they can trust us, but they appear to be dealing openly. They've sent us a gift. Steel suits of their own manufacture. Maps of certain desert areas surrounding strong points the Harkonnens left behind."
He glanced down at the table.
"Their intelligence reports have proved completely reliable and have helped us considerably in our dealings with the Judge of the Change. They've also sent some incidental things. Jewelry for the Lady Jessica, spice liquor, candy, medicinals. My men are processing the lot right now. There appears to be no trickery."
"You like these people, Thufir?"
asked a man down the table. Hawat turned to face his questioner.
"Duncan Idaho says they're to be admired."
Paul glanced at his father, back to Hawat, ventured a question.
"Have you any new information on how many Fremen there are?"
Hawat looked at Paul.
"From food processing and other evidence, Idaho estimates the cave complex he visited consisted of some 10,000 people, all told. Their leader said he ruled a CH of 2,000 hearths. We've reason to believe there are a great many such CH communities. All seem to give their allegiance to someone called Liet."
"That's something new," Leto said.
"It could be an error on my part, sire. There are things to suggest this Liet may be a local deity."
Another man down the table cleared his throat, asked,
Is it certain they deal with the smugglers?
A smuggler caravan left this Sietch while Idaho was there, carrying a heavy load of spice. They used pack beasts and indicated they faced an 18-day journey.
It appears, the Duke said, that the smugglers have redoubled their operations during this period of unrest. This deserves some careful thought. We shouldn't worry too much about unlicensed frigates working off our planet. It's always done. But have them completely outside our observation, that's not good.
You have a plan, sir?
Howard asked. The Duke looked at Halleck.
Gurney, I want you to head a delegation, an embassy, if you will, to contact these romantic businessmen. Tell them I'll ignore their operations as long as they give me a ducal tithe.
Howard here estimates that graft and extra fighting men heretofore required in their operations have been costing them 4 times that amount.
What if the Emperor gets wind of this? Halleck asked. He's very jealous of his Chom profits, my lord.
Leto smiled.
We'll bank the entire tithe openly in the name of Shaddam the Fourth, and deduct it legally from our levy support costs.
Let the Harkonnens fight that. And we'll be ruining a few more of the locals who grew fat under the Harkonnen system. No more graft.
A grin twisted Halleck's face.
Ah, my lord, a beautiful low blow. Would that I could see the Baron's face when he learns of this.
The Duke turned to Howard.
Thufir, did you get those account books you said you could buy?
Yes, my lord. They're being examined in detail even now. I've skimmed them, though, and can give a first approximation.
Give it, then.
The Harkonnens took 10 billion Solaris out of here every 330 standard days.
A muted gasp ran around the table. Even the younger aides who had been betraying some boredom sat up straighter and exchanged wide-eyed looks. Halleck murmured,
"For they shall suck of the abundance of the seas and of the treasure hid in the sand."
"You see, gentlemen," Leto said, "is there anyone here so naive he believes the Harkonnens have quietly packed up and walked away from all this merely because the Emperor ordered it?"
There was a general shaking of heads, murmurous agreement.
"We will have to take it at the point of the sword," Leto said.
He turned to Howard.
"This would be a good point to report on equipment. How many sand crawlers, harvesters, spice factories, and supporting equipment have they left us?"
"A full complement, as it says in the Imperial inventory, audited by the Judge of the Change, my lord,"
Howard said. He gestured for an aide to pass him a folder, opened the folder on the table in front of him.
"They neglect to mention that less than half the crawlers are operable, that only about a third have carryalls to fly them to spice sands, that everything the Harkonnens left us is ready to break down and fall apart. We'll be lucky to get half the equipment into operation, and luckier yet if a fourth of it's still working 6 months from now."
"Pretty much as we expected," Leto said. "What's the firm estimate on basic equipment?"
Howard glanced at his folder.
"About 930 harvester factories that can be sent out in a few days. About 6,250 ornithopters for survey, scouting, and weather observation. Carryalls a little under 1,000.
Halleck said, "Wouldn't it be cheaper to reopen negotiations with the Guild for permission to orbit a frigate as a weather satellite?"
The Duke looked at Howard.
"Nothing new there, eh, Thufir?"
"We must pursue other avenues for now," Howard said. "The Guild agent wasn't really negotiating with us. He was merely making it plain, one mentor to another, that the price was out of our reach and would remain so no matter how long a reach we develop. Our task is to find out why, before we approach him again."
One of Halleck's aides down the table swiveled in his chair, snapped,
"There's no justice in this."
"Justice?"
The Duke looked at the man.
"Who asks for justice? We make our own justice. We make it here on Arrakis, win or die. Do you regret casting your lot with us, sir?"
The man stared at the Duke, then,
"No, sir.
You couldn't turn, and I could do naught but follow you. Forgive the outburst, but..."
He shrugged.
"We must all feel bitter at times."
"Bitterness I understand," the Duke said. "But let us not rail about justice as long as we have arms and the freedom to use them. Do any of the rest of you harbour bitterness? If so, let it out. This is friendly counsel where any man may speak his mind."
Halleck stirred, said,
I think what rankles, sire, is that we've had no volunteers from the other great houses. They address you as Leto the Just and promise eternal friendship, but only as long as it doesn't cost them anything.
They don't know yet who's going to win this exchange, the Duke said. Most of the houses have grown fat by taking few risks. One cannot truly blame them for this. One can only despise them.
He looked at Howard.
We were discussing equipment. Would you care to project a few examples to familiarize the men with this machinery?
Howard nodded, gestured to an aide at the projector. A Solido Tri-D projection appeared on the table surface about a third of the way down from the Duke. Some of the men farther along the table stood up to get a better look at it. Paul leaned forward, staring at the machine. Scaled against the tiny projected human figures around it, the thing was about 120 meters long and about 40 meters wide. It was basically a long, bug-like body moving on independent sets of wide tracks.
This is a harvester factory, Howard said. We chose one in good repair for this projection. There's one dragline outfit that came in with the first team of Imperial ecologists, though, and it's still running, although I don't know how or why.
If that's the one they call Old Maria, it belongs in a museum, an aide said. I think the Harkonnens kept it as a punishment job, a threat hanging over their workers' heads. Be good or you'll be assigned to Old Maria.
Chuckles sounded around the table. Paul held himself apart from the humour, his attention focused on the projection and the question that filled his mind. He pointed to the image on the table, said,
Thufir, are there sandworms big enough to swallow that hole?
Quick silence settled on the table. The Duke cursed under his breath, then thought,
No, they have to face the realities here. There are worms in the deep desert could take this entire factory in one gulp. Howard said. Up here, closer to the shield wall where most of the spicing's done, there are plenty of worms that could cripple this factory and devour it at their leisure.
Why don't we shield them? Paul asked.
According to Idaho's report, Howard said, shields are dangerous in the desert. A body-sized shield will call every worm for hundreds of meters around. It appears to drive them into a killing frenzy. We've the Fremen word on this and no reason to doubt it. Idaho saw no evidence of shield equipment at the CH.
None at all? Paul asked.
It'd be pretty hard to conceal that kind of thing among several thousand people, Howard said. Idaho had free access to every part of the CH. He saw no shields or any indication of their use.
It's a puzzle, the Duke said.
The Harkonnens certainly used plenty of shields here, Howard said. They had repair depots in every garrison village, and their accounts show a heavy expenditure for shield replacements and parts.
Could the Fremen have a way of nullifying shields? Paul asked.
It doesn't seem likely, Howard said. It's theoretically possible, of course. A Shire-sized static countercharge is supposed to do the trick, but no one's ever been able to put it to the test.
We'd have heard about it before now, Halleck said. The smugglers have close contact with the Fremen, and would have acquired such a device if it were available. And they'd have had no inhibitions against marketing an off-planet.
I don't like an unanswered question of this importance, Leto said. Thufir, I want you to give top priority to solution of this problem.
We're already working on it, my lord.
He cleared his throat.
Idaho did say one thing. He said you couldn't mistake the Fremen attitude toward shields. He said they were mostly amused by them.
The Duke frowned, then...
The subject under discussion is spicing equipment.
Howard gestured to his aide at the projector. The Solido image of the harvester factory was replaced by a projection of a winged device that dwarfed the images of human figures around it.
This is a carry-all, Howard said. It's essentially a large thopter whose sole function is to deliver a factory to spice-rich sands, then to rescue the factory when a sandworm appears.
They always appear.
Harvesting the spice is a process of getting in and getting out with as much as possible.
Admirably suited to Harkonnen morality, the Duke said.
Laughter was abrupt and too loud. An ornithopter replaced the carry-all in the projection focus.
These thopters are fairly conventional, Howard said. Major modifications give them extended range. Extra care has been used in sealing essential areas against sand and dust.
Only about 1 in 30 is shielded, possibly discarding the shield generator's weight for greater range.
I don't like this. De-emphasis on shields, the Duke muttered. And he thought, is this the Harkonnen secret? Does it mean we won't even be able to escape on shielded frigates if all goes against us? He shook his head sharply to drive out such thoughts. Said,
let's get to the working estimate. What'll our profit figure be?
Howard turned 2 pages in his notebook.
After assessing the repairs and operable equipment, we've worked out a first estimate on operating costs. It's based naturally on a depreciated figure for a clear safety margin.
He closed his eyes in mentat semitrance, said,
under the Harkonnens, maintenance and salaries were held to 14%. We'll be lucky to make it at 30% at first. With reinvestment and growth factors accounted for, including the Chome percentage and military costs, our profit margin will be reduced to a very narrow 6 or 7% until we can replace worn-out equipment. We then should be able to boost it up to 12 or 15% where it belongs.
He opened his eyes.
Unless my lord wishes to adopt Harkonnen methods.
We are working for a solid and permanent planetary base, the Duke said. We have to keep a large percentage of the people happy, especially the Fremen.
Most especially the Fremen, Howard agreed.
Our supremacy on Caladan, the Duke said, depended on sea and air power. Here we must develop something I choose to call desert power. This may include air power, but it's possible it may not. I call your attention to the lack of thopter shields.
He shook his head.
The Harkonnens relied on turnover from off-planet for some of their key personnel. We don't dare. Each new lot would have its quota of provocateurs.
Then we'll have to be content with far less profit and reduced harvest, Howard said. Our output the first 2 seasons should be down a third from the Harkonnen average.
There it is, the Duke said, exactly as we expected. We'll have to move fast with the Fremen. I'd like 5 full battalions of Fremen troops before the first Chome audit.
That's not much time, sir, Howard said.
We don't have much time, as you well know. They'll be here with Sardauka disguised as Harkonnens at the first opportunity. How many do you think they'll ship in, Thufir?
4 or 5 battalions all told, sir. No more. Guild troop transport costs being what they are.
Then 5 battalions of Fremen plus our own forces ought to do it. Let us have a few captive Sardauka to parade in front of the Landsrat Council, and matters will be much different. Profits or no profits.
We'll do our best, sir.
Paul looked at his father, back to Howard, suddenly conscious of the Mentat's great age, aware that the old man had served 3 generations of Atreides. Aged. It showed in the rheumy shine of the brown eyes, in the cheeks cracked and burned by exotic weathers, in the rounded curve of the shoulders and the thin set of his lips, with the cranberry-coloured stain of Sappho juice. So much depends on one aged man, Paul thought.
We're presently in a war of assassins, the Duke said, but it has not achieved full scale. Thufir, what's the condition of the Harkonnen machine here?
We've eliminated 259 of their key people, my lord. No more than 3 Harkonnen cells remain. Perhaps 100 people in all.
These Harkonnen creatures you eliminated, the Duke said. Were they propertied?
Most were well situated, my lord. In the entrepreneur class.
I want you to forge certificates of allegiance over the signatures of each of them, the Duke said. File copies with the judge of the change. We'll take the legal position that they stayed under false allegiance. Confiscate their property. Take everything, turn out their families, strip them, and make sure the Crown gets its 10%. It must be entirely legal.
Thufir smiled, revealing red-stained teeth beneath the carmine lips.
A move worthy of your grandsire, my lord. It shames me that I didn't think of it first.
Halleck frowned across the table, noticing a deep scowl on Paul's face. The others were smiling and nodding.
It's wrong, Paul thought. This'll only make the others fight all the harder. They've nothing to gain by surrendering.
He knew the actual no-holds-barred convention that ruled in Canley, but this was the sort of move that could destroy them, even as it gave them victory.
I have been a stranger in a strange land,
Halleck quoted. Paul stared at him, recognizing the quotation from the OC Bible, wondering, does Gurney, too, wish an end to devious plots? The Duke glanced at the darkness out the windows, looked back at Halleck.
Gurney, how many of those sand workers did you persuade to stay with us?
286 in all, sire. I think we should take them and consider ourselves lucky. They're all in useful categories.
No more?
The Duke pursed his lips.
Then, well, pass the word along to—
A disturbance at the door interrupted him. Duncan Idaho came through the guard there, hurried down the length of the table and bent over the Duke's ear. Leto waved him back, said,
Speak out, Duncan. You can see this is strategy stuff.
Paul studied Idaho, marking the feline movements, the swiftness of reflex that made him such a difficult weapons teacher to emulate. Idaho's dark, round face turned toward Paul. The cave-sitter eyes gave no hint of recognition, but Paul recognized the mask of serenity over excitement. Idaho looked down the length of the table, said,
We've taken a force of Harkonnen mercenaries disguised as Fremen. The Fremen themselves sent us a courier to warn of the false band. In the attack, however, we found the Harkonnens had waylaid the Fremen courier, badly wounded him. We were bringing him here for treatment by our medics when he died. I'd seen how badly off the man was and stopped to do what I could. I surprised him in the attempt to throw something away.
Idaho glanced down at Leto.
A knife, my lord. A knife, the like of which you've never seen.
Chris knife?
Someone asked.
No doubt of it, Idaho said. Milky white and glowing with a light of its own like.
He reached into his tunic, brought out a sheath with a black ridged handle protruding from it.
Keep that blade in its sheath.
The voice came from the open door at the end of the room, a vibrant and penetrating voice that brought them all up, staring. A tall, robed figure stood in the door, barred by the crossed swords of the guard. A light tan robe completely enveloped the man except for a gap in the hood and black veil that exposed eyes of total blue. No white in them at all.
Let him enter,
Idaho whispered.
Pass that man, the Duke said.
The guards hesitated, then lowered their swords. The man swept into the room, stood across from the Duke.
This is Stilgar, chief of the CH I visited, leader of those who warned us of the false band, Idaho said.
Welcome, sir,
Leto said. And why shouldn't we unsheath this blade?
Stilgar glanced at Idaho, said,
You observed the customs of cleanliness and honour among us. I would permit you to see the blade of the man you befriended.
His gaze swept the others in the room.
But I do not know these others. Would you have them defile an honourable weapon?
I am the Duke Leto, the Duke said. Would you permit me to see this blade?
I'll permit you to earn the right to unsheath it, Stilgar said.
And as a mutter of protest sounded around the table, he raised a thin, darkly veined hand.
I remind you, this is the blade of one who befriended you.
In the waiting silence, Paul studied the man, sensing the aura of power that radiated from him. He was a leader, a Fremen leader. A man near the centre of the table across from Paul muttered,
Who's he to tell us what rights we have on Arrakis?
It is said that the Duke Leto Atreides rules with the consent of the governed,
the Fremen said.
Thus I must tell you the way it is with us. A certain responsibility falls on those who have seen a Chris knife.
He passed a dark glance across Idaho.
They are ours. They may never leave Arrakis without our consent.
Halleck and several of the others started to rise, angry expressions on their faces. Halleck said,
The Duke Leto determines whether...
One moment, please, Leto said. And the very mildness of his voice held them.
This must not get out of hand, he thought.
He addressed himself to the Fremen.
Sir, I honour and respect the personal dignity of any man who respects my dignity. I am indeed indebted to you, and I always pay my debts. If it is your custom that this knife remain sheathed here,
then it is so ordered by me. And if there is any other way we may honour the man who died in our service, you have but to name it." The Fremen stared at the Duke, then slowly pulled aside his veil, revealing a thin nose and full-lipped mouth in a glistening black beard. Deliberately, he bent over the end of the table, spat on its polished surface. As the men around the table started to surge to their feet, Idaho's voice boomed across the room. "Hold!" Into the sudden charged stillness, Idaho said, "We thank you, Stilgar, for the life of your body's moisture. We accept it in the spirit with which it is given." And Idaho spat on the table in front of the Duke. Aside to the Duke, he said, "Remember how precious water is here, sire. That was a token of respect." Leto sank back into his own chair, caught Paul's eye, a rueful grin on his son's face, sensed the slow relaxation of tension around the table as understanding came to his men. The Fremen looked at Idaho, said,
"You measured well in my siege, Duncan Idaho. Is there a bond on your allegiance to your Duke?"
"He's asking me to enlist with him, sire," Idaho said. "Would he accept a dual allegiance?" Leto asked. "You wish me to go with him, sire?"
"I wish you to make your own decision in the matter," Leto said,
and he could not keep the urgency out of his voice. Idaho studied the Fremen.
"Would you have me under these conditions, Stilgar? There'd be times when I'd have to return to serve my Duke." "You fight well, and you did your best for our friend," Stilgar said.
He looked at Leto.
"Let it be thus. The man Idaho keeps the kris knife he holds as a mark of his allegiance to us. He must be cleansed, of course, and the rites observed, but this can be done. He will be Fremen and soldier of the Atreides. There is precedent for this. Liet serves two masters."
"Duncan?" Leto asked. "I understand, sir," Idaho said.
"It is agreed, then," Leto said. "Your water is ours, Duncan Idaho," Stilgar said. "The body of our friend remains with your Duke. His water is Atreides' water. It is a bond between us."
Leto sighed, glanced at Howat, catching the old Mentat's eye. Howat nodded, his expression pleased.
"I will await below," Stilgar said, "while Idaho makes farewell with his friends. Turok was the name of our dead friend. Remember that when it comes time to release his spirit. You are friends of Turok."
Stilgar started to turn away.
"Will you not stay a while?" Leto asked.
The Fremen turned back, whipping his veil into place with a casual gesture, adjusting something beneath it. Paul glimpsed what looked like a thin tube before the veil settled into place.
"Is there reason to stay?"
the Fremen asked.
"We would honour you," the Duke said. "Honour requires that I be elsewhere soon," the Fremen said.
He shot another glance at Idaho, whirled and strode out past the door guards.
"If the other Fremen match him, we'll serve each other well," Leto said.
Idaho spoke in a dry voice.
"He's a fair sample, sire." "You understand what you're to do, Duncan?"
"I'm your ambassador to the Fremen, sire."
"Much depends on you, Duncan. We're going to need at least 5 battalions of those people before the Sardauka descend on us."
"This is going to take some doing, sire. The Fremen are a pretty independent bunch."
Idaho hesitated. Then,
"And, sire, there's one other thing. One of the mercenaries we knocked over was trying to get this blade from our dead Fremen friend. The mercenary says there's a Harkonnen reward of 1,000,000 solaris for anyone who'll bring in a single kris knife."
Leto's chin came up in a movement of obvious surprise. "Why do they want one of those blades so badly?"
"The knife is ground from a sandworm's tooth. It's the mark of the Fremen, sire. With it, a blue-eyed man could penetrate any siege in the land. They'd question me unless I were known. I don't look Fremen, but..."
"Peter de Vries," the Duke said.
"A man of devilish cunning, my lord," Howat said.
Idaho slipped the sheathed knife beneath his tunic.
"Guard that knife," the Duke said.
I understand, my lord.
He patted the transceiver on his belt kit.
I'll report as soon as possible. Thufir has my call code. Use battle language.
He saluted, spun about, and hurried after the Fremen. They heard his footsteps drumming down the corridor. A look of understanding passed